Alex Zaharoff-Reut and Talkin' Tech on today's News Talk TNT.
Thank you for joining me. My name is Alex Zaharoff-Reut, and we're talking tech on TNT Radio Live, the home of freedom and free speech, and where we take a weekly look at where this incredible technological journey we're on is taking us next. And also, yes, Jason Olborn, I was chatting with him just briefly on messaging, and he was saying, he thought it was, he was looking at tomorrow's script where it will be cinema after his show, but it is definitely talking tech with me right now. Now, a couple of bits of news before we get on to our guest. Apple is clearly saving its biggest AI announcements for its Worldwide Developer Conference from June 10 onwards. But we just saw that the new M4 chip from Apple, which launched with a new super thin iPad Pros, has been designed from the ground up to work with AI. So this means it's most likely to announce that a whole series of generative AI capabilities will be able to be done on the chip rather than having to go to the cloud. And I'm sure there will still be elements that will want to go to the cloud for. Apple is also supposed to be having created its own data center chips using its M Series Ultra technology, which will mean that it's not having to use chips from NVIDIA, Intel, AMD, or Qualcomm to process all of the data. Now, its chip is claiming 38 trillion instructions per second, known as TOPS. And while Qualcomm says its chip running on the same kind of ARM architecture, processor architecture that is in Apple's iPhone, iPad, and Mac chips, and also in the Samsung chips, I mean, the same, not the same chip, but the same type of chips, they say that their chip operates at 45 TOPS, but Apple still says that its chip is super fast and operates at much lower power levels than competitors. I mean, we're yet to see some benchmark testing and the real world examples of that. But Apple is vertically integrated, so it can fine tune its apps, its AI, and its hardware to work as smoothly together as possible. There's no need for Apple to pay the Microsoft Windows tax, where historically Intel and AMD have delivered faster speeds, but Windows then soaks up that power to make things slower again. And we also have the new pencil that you can squeeze, and you can turn it around to get different brush types, and it's got haptic feedback so you can feel it. Now, Microsoft also has an event planned for May 20, where it's expected to announce its new state-of-the-art AI PCs running on both Intel and Qualcomm's new chip, which operates using the same kind of low power but super high performance on the ARM technology, different to what Intel and AMD has got. And that's one of the reasons, supposedly, why Apple came out with its chip announcement and its iPads this week, and is saving a lot of these big AI announcements for June the 10th, where there's going to be sort of a five-day conference. Now, we also have a new smartphone from Google, the Pixel 8a. Reviews are not able to be shared yet, but it has most of the features of the Pixel 8 at a sort of a similar price in the States. I mean, in Australia, it's a couple of $100 difference, but it does have all of that AI goodness that Google has been sharing, the tap at the bottom where the white line is at the bottom of the screen, and you can see the screen shimmer, and then you can do a circle to search. So you see something on the screen, someone's got a pair of sneakers or there's a computer, something there, you can draw a circle around it, and then Google will show that to you. It's got other features inside where you can summarize information that you've recorded to a voice recorder. And their big developer conference is also on next week, called Google I/O. So Apple in a month, Google next week. There'll be a preview of Android 15 and lots of AI things that we're yet to see. But look, it's now time to introduce today's guest. His name is Professor Andrew Jurak. He is the CEO and founder of Dirac. A similar name there, we'll find out about that a bit later on. But this is a pioneering quantum computing company with some very real advances over the rest of the industry, which we'll soon be talking about. And he's also a Scientia Professor of Quantum Engineering at the University of New South Wales. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Alex, great to see you again.
Yes, wonderful. And I was at the launch of the labs that you had there. We'll talk about that in a moment. But Andrew, we have a global audience with people from all walks of life, many of whom might be more acquainted with the TV show Quantum Leap than they would be with quantum computing. So let's start at the beginning. What is quantum computing and how does it differ from the computing that we do on our PCs, Macs, smartphones, and tablets?
Yeah, so quantum computing uses principles of quantum physics to provide enhanced computing compared to the computers that we use every day. The key aspect of it was come up was invented by a professor at Caltech many years ago in the 80s called Richard Feynman, who was asked to think about what could be the ultimate future of computing as, you know, as more and more bits got crammed onto a chip, what ultimately could these do? And he said that, well, you know, we can keep making, getting more and more bits on a chip, but there are certain problems that even the most powerful supercomputer won't be able to solve if it uses conventional computing. And these are problems that occur in nature. For example, trying to predict the behavior of a molecule that could be, for example, a protein in your body. It could be a virus, or ultimately it could be a pharmaceutical that attacks those viruses. And the reason that these, that in order to predict the way these behave is complex, is because these molecules are actually quantum mechanical systems themselves. So nature is governed by a type of physics called quantum mechanics, which describes the behavior that microscopic, the way microscopic particles interact. And it turns out that the mathematics describing these is very complex. There are many variables, and those variables increase exponentially as we increase the atoms in a molecule. And that makes calculating them ultimately impossible once we get molecules that, you know, the size of things that we might use in pharmaceuticals or the chemical industry. So even the biggest supercomputers can't solve those sorts of problems. And Feynman recognized that if, however, you actually used quantum particles or quantum systems themselves to simulate computing, to perform computing, then you would be able to ultimately solve these complex problems. And so quantum computing is a way of harnessing quantum particles in order to encode bits of information and then solve these problems that up to this point are currently intractable.
Now, I've also heard that quantum computers could, for example, crack passwords that might take regular computers hundreds of years to guess in just a few seconds. I mean, that's one of the sort of, the practical applications. I mean, what else can a quantum computer allow an individual to do? I mean, I guess the other question is, you know, if quantum computing is so revolutionary, why aren't the computers and devices that we use today already powered by quantum computing technologies?
Yeah, so those are two separate questions. Maybe I'll take the second one first.
Sure, yeah.
Why aren't we today using quantum computers? And the answer is that the sorts of, I said quantum particles. So firstly, you know, to your audience, I mean, what is a quantum particle? It's an obvious question. So the basic particles of nature, like electrons that make up, you know, are the main constituent in atoms and that carry the electricity and electrical currents, okay, in electronics. A single electron is a classic example of a quantum particle. Another example is a photon, a particle of light. So these are obviously very, very small pieces of matter, as small as you can possibly get. They are the fundamental particles of nature. And in order to enable quantum computing, it requires engineers to be able to control these single particles, single electrons. In the case of our company, we manipulate single electrons, or in other company technologies, they manipulate single photons, single particles of light. These are obviously very fragile. And in order to manipulate these and control them at this single particle level requires some very, very advanced engineering. And it was really only the idea, as I said, of using quantum particles for computing was first proposed in the 1980s. The example you mentioned earlier about using quantum computers to crack public key encryption codes, that was the idea of that algorithm was formulated in the mid-1990s. But really the first useful, you know, quantum bits, demonstrations of quantum bits really only happened around about the turn of the century, around 1999, 2000. And it's only been really in the last 5 to 10 years that the ability to perform quantum calculations with anything more than one or two quantum bits has happened. So we've got examples, for example, using superconducting devices, using trapped ions and so on, where there are examples of tens of these quantum bits, tens of qubits being used to perform calculations. And that is already requiring development by very, very large teams, by very big corporations. I mean, companies like IBM, Google, and Intel and so on are working in this area, as well as many startup companies like our own. So it's a very big engineering challenge. It's been compared to example to landing a human on the moon in terms of its engineering complexity. And so therefore, it's not something that can happen overnight. So that's why we're not using them now. I mean, our company and many others are driving hard to develop the technology as quickly as we can, because we'd like to start to get commercially useful quantum computers as soon as the next 3 to 4 years. I talk more about, for example, our plans on that in a moment.
Yes. Well, I'm going to ask you about your company, Dirac, in a moment, but just to set the scene for the audience, I mean, a quantum computer needs to operate at super cold temperatures. So it's like having a freezer on steroids to be able to host the technology so that it runs and everything is stable. And then in theory, you need to have millions of these qubits, not the one or two bits. And one of the other problems we're going to talk about is the fact that at the moment, there can be a lot of errors and you need error correction. But just before we sort of go into all of that, a lot of people may have heard of the Schrodinger's cat, where the cat is in this box and until you look at the cat, it's either alive or dead, and it's not until you see it. What does that have to do with quantum technology?
Yeah, look, very good question. So the one of the fundamental principles of quantum mechanics, which describes the way these fundamental particles work and the way nature works, is that quantum particles are able to exist in multiple states at the same time.
Which doesn't sound like it's something that happens in nature, but behind the scenes, that's what's happening.
It is happening at the microscopic level, in every molecule in our body, in every molecule in the seat you're sitting in. It is the way nature works. We don't see it at a macroscopic level because all of these things average out, okay? And there's this principle that at a certain size, things start to behave or appear as if they're behaving classically, non-quantumly. Mm. But at the microscopic level, everything is this very uncertain world. You might have heard of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. Okay, so this describes the inability to describe all of the properties of a quantum particle at any one time. You can only know completely one aspect, not all aspects. So going back to your question about Schrodinger's cat, so Schrodinger was one of the founders of quantum theory in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. He won the Nobel Prize together with Paul Dirac, which our company is named after. We'll talk about that later. Schrodinger, there was a concept of trying to describe a way that when we measure or try to observe a quantum particle, it forces it to choose one of those various states it can be in. So coming back to a specific example, particles of light or photons, people might be familiar with polarization. So, you know, our sunglasses are often polarized, and that defines a particular axis of the electric or magnetic field associated with the photon. And you can polarize it vertically or horizontally. So you might know if you rotate your sunglasses, you see the shading in the sky change, right? That's due to the polarization. So a photon can either be polarized in the horizontal direction or in the vertical direction. And now it turns out that photon can actually be in both of those possible states at the same time. But when we measure it, it will choose one or the other. Okay, these are called the basis states. And in quantum computing, this allows us to use those quantum particles as a quantum bit. So for example, we could define the horizontal polarization as a zero and the vertical polarization as a one. And then when we measure it, we will only get a zero or a one as the answer for measuring that particular quantum bit. But before we measure it, it can exist in both of those, a zero and a one at the same time. And this, in fact, it turns out that in the quantum world, you can actually store even more information than that on a single bit of information. And this fact that there is more information that can be stored in a quantum bit than can be stored in a conventional bit, such as that we use in modern transistors, means that when we do a calculation, we have far more numerical possibilities available to us, and it allows us to solve these problems with very many variables and ultimately find the correct solution to particular answers, be that the way a particular molecule will behave, the way a particular pharmaceutical will affect a virus. So that is how this so-called quantum superposition of states is used to enhance the power and make quantum computing well beyond anything that conventional computing can do.
And just to break it down for the audience that is not sort of an expert in this, this is because these bits can store so much more information than the traditional zero and one of the bits and bytes that are in our regular computers. This is why a encryption code that would take hundreds of years to break with a normal computer can be done in theory in seconds with a quantum computer.
That's exactly right. That's right. Yeah. It's the amount of effective solutions that the quantum computer can look at in parallel that is just not possible in a conventional computer.
It's like brute force on steroids.
Yeah, you can think of it that way.
Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to break it down because I mean, most of the time you're speaking with colleagues and with university students who are well versed in this. And I mean, in effect, and we're going to go into more details in a moment. But you know, the computers that we saw from the 1950s that took up entire football fields or entire sort of stadium sizes. I mean, quantum computing is going to make today's computers seem like those primitive ones from 70 or 80 years ago.
Well, yes and no. Okay. So yes, in the sense that quantum computers will be able to solve problems that simply can't be performed with existing computers. Now, it wouldn't matter if we took all of the computers on the planet and we made them 10 times bigger and put them all together and tried to run a calculation. There are problems such as this molecular design that simply cannot be done on conventional computers. And that could be done with one single quantum computer, for example. Mm. So in that sense, yes, it makes modern computing look very poor in comparison. However, it is important to appreciate that not all types of problems and calculations are suited to quantum computing in the sense that you can do them with a quantum computer, but you actually don't get any advantage over a conventional computer. In fact, for many problems, a quantum computer is actually less efficient than a conventional computer. Okay. It is important to appreciate quantum computing will not replace existing computing. Yeah. It will provide capabilities that we currently don't have. And a good example that I like to give is what we've seen over the last couple of years with generative AI, okay, which is now providing algorithms and the ability to solve problems, apply applications that simply have not been possible up until today. And the way that that has been made possible is by alternative forms of classical processing and some very, very clever algorithms and codes that run on it in order to really enhance machine learning and artificial intelligence. And we've seen revolutionary changes from that. We expect that we will see similar revolutionary changes in the sorts of things that mankind can do with computers when we have quantum computing. But, you know, AI doesn't change absolutely everything, of course, right?
Well, look, I'm sure the traditional computer makers are very happy to hear that quantum computing is not going to wipe them out. But we're going to talk about Dirac in a moment. Andrew, we're just going to take a quick break. So I'm just going to ask the audience, hey, why not give TNT Radio a follow? We are on all of the major platforms, including Facebook, X, Instagram, Gab, and Getter. Please help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time right here on today's News Talk. TNT. See you after
Los Angeles has been described as a suburb looking for a city. Join me as we explore LA's neighborhoods and the local restaurants, cafes, and bars that are an integral part of these vibrant and diverse communities.
Today, we are going to cook a small steak for people who are really quite hungry.
Very, very simple. A couple squeezes of lemon in there.
Since you're adding the meat, and you can do it with tofu options as well for the vegetarians.
Olive oil. So now we're gonna season it up. fresh grind black pepper.
Really hot and busy in here.
I'm gonna go ahead and make some buttered toast.
Olive oil.
Ah, smells, really smells good.
Grab our shiitake mushrooms.
Season with salt a little bit.
Boy, it's getting hot in the kitchen. Need another drink of my beer. Ah, that's the best part of cooking.
And we are ready to put our plate together.
Add the mussels right around the rim. See, we have really nice colors, nice piece of fish.
We just need to add a little bit of powdered sugar.
And I will just put a little bit of reduction glaze over the top.
When you add a pesto like this onto a braised meat, the smells that just come up are just wonderful. Take it from me, you've got a good thing going here.
TNT is an independent global news talk station that does what others only say they do. TNT is a live radio and TV broadcaster that simply tells the truth 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. No one in the world does what we do, crisscrossing the globe, providing credible news and opinion all day and all night. In 2.5 years, TNT has become a credible and exciting platform with brilliant hosts and staff. It's a critical time, and we must continue to call out the misinformation and propaganda from mainstream media and their powerful sponsors. We're now appealing to our many friends and supporters around the world to go to tntradio.live and make a small donation to TNT while we seek the right investors to continue our important mission. Today's News Talk Radio.
Now we're talking.
TNT.
Thank you for joining us again on TNT Radio. This is Talking Tech with Alex Zaharov-Royt, and my guest today is Andrew Jurek. Now, Andrew, besides being a professor of quantum engineering at the University of New South Wales, you're also an innovator and an entrepreneur. You're the CEO and founder of quantum computing company Dirac. So what does Dirac do?
So Dirac is a company that I formed with private investment in 2022. And we're focused on building quantum computers using very similar manufacturing to what's used to make the computers that we use today and the chips that we use today in our iPhones, laptops, data centers. So that technology is known as silicon CMOS technology. So I think that a lot of your listeners at least familiar with the concept of a silicon chip. Mm-hmm. Those silicon chips that we have in our phones and laptops today have many billions of transistors on them, silicon transistors. These are electronic devices that allow us to process the bits of information, the zeros and ones. Okay. Mm-hmm. And the term CMOS is a term that's generally used for the manufacturing technology. It comes from the type of transistors that are used, which are called MOS, MOSFETs, stands for metal oxide semiconductor field effect transistor. These were invented in the 1950s and demonstrated in the 1950s, and they make up well over 99.9% of the transistors that use up that are in all of our chips today. And what we showed, we actually demonstrated this almost a decade ago in our research group at UNSW. We showed that we can convert one of those MOSFET transistors into a quantum bit, essentially a CMOS qubit. And the great benefit of this is that we can now use standard chip manufacturing plants to make many, many quantum bits, just like we use it to make standard classical bits or classical transistors. So you talked before when we were talking about the fragility of qubits and how they're very difficult to maintain. You also mentioned the fact that there are many errors that occur, of course, because of this fragility. And because there are so many errors that occur in quantum bits, it means that you have to make many, many replicas of quantum bits in order to fight against those errors. So actually, you need ultimately many millions of quantum bits in order to perform the error correction that then allows that quantum processor to do useful calculations of the type we were talking about before, like molecular design. Now, the great thing about, of course, silicon chip technology and CMOS manufacturing is that we already have a way of making billions of standard transistors on a chip. And so because we've leveraged that technology, we can now make many millions and ultimately billions of quantum bits on a chip. So Dirac, our company, is all about building quantum computers using this standard chip technology, chip manufacturing technology. We obviously design the layout of the quantum bits differently, but we can use the same sort of engineering design tools that are used to make conventional chips. And in fact, we can get our chips made in chip manufacturing foundries around the world that make the chips and CPUs and GPUs that are used today. So the company, as I said, began in just 2 years ago. In fact, last night we had our second birthday with the whole team here in Sydney. Now around about 40 people, growing rapidly with some recent investment. And we are on a roadmap that by 2028, we're intending to have a full quantum computing system. At that stage, it'll be in the many thousands of qubits, but it will already be at a level where we'll be able to tackle problems that at the moment can't be done with a conventional computer. And then we have a roadmap a few years after that when we're intending to start to tackle those really, really valuable problems like molecular design.
And how is this different to the way traditional or other quantum computing companies are creating their chips? Because from what I understand, Dirac is revolutionary in using this approach, which, as you just said, is able to be manufactured by the same companies like, for example, TSMC that makes the iPhone chips and the AMD chips and Intel chips, which is, to me, that's like a huge difference.
That's right. So I mentioned earlier that the first quantum bits were demonstrated around about the turn of the century, and those included superconducting circuits, for example, and there's a lot of research on and commercial work now on making quantum processors based on chips using superconducting circuits. One of the challenges with those is the actual circuits are very, very large compared to the transistors or the quantum bits that we make. So the size of a transistor in a modern integrated circuit is measured now in, say, 20 nanometers or below. To put that in perspective, the width of a human hair is around 50 microns. So if you can imagine that you can get 1,000 transistors or more, maybe 10,000, spread across the width of one hair on your head, then that gives you an idea of how small modern silicon transistors are. In contrast, for example, superconducting qubits are something like 100 microns across. So what that means is that you have a density of silicon qubits, which is millions of times greater than you do of superconducting qubits. And so it means that on one chip, you can have everything you need for an error-corrected processor, whereas other technologies like superconducting, and I just give that as one example, but it also holds true for ion trap technology, for photonic technology. These require many, many separate chips that have to be put into specialized systems. Generally, you mentioned earlier, cryogenic systems to cool them down. And so that means that those other technologies require physically very large systems to build a single computer, something you know, the size of a building or a sizable fraction of a building, whereas our computers are effectively, you know, the size of a refrigerator in your house. And so that really is the big advantage of the silicon technology over the alternate technologies out there.
And obviously, cooling things to that degree with cryogenics requires a huge amount of energy, which your chips don't need in comparison.
That's right. It's a matter of scale. So we still need a refrigeration system. So just to explain to your listeners, you know, why you need refrigerators. So again, as I was giving you examples before, our company works with single electrons. Other companies work with single photons or particles of light. Very fragile systems. In order to keep these quantum states in a controllable state without them becoming randomized, you need to keep them very cold. All right, this is an analogy which isn't really accurate, but it gives you an idea. Imagine, you know, when you get everything gets colder and everything slows down and kind of freezes. That's by doing that, we keep the system under control. At room temperature, unfortunately, most of these quantum properties just get randomized and you can't do useful computing. And so you have to cool things. And as you said, and the temperatures that we're talking about are a lot colder than the fridge in our house, right? Mm-hmm. We're talking temperatures near absolute zero. So for example, superconducting qubits need to be cooled down to something like 1/100th of a degree above absolute zero. Our qubits can be quite a bit warmer. We sit at around about 1 Kelvin. For photonic qubits, they generally sit at around about 3 Kelvin because you need these specialized superconducting detectors to measure the photons. So all of the technologies require some level of cryogenics. And one of the refrigerators, a typical fridge refrigerator that we use to get down to that, you know, 1 Kelvin type temperature, typically takes a couple of maybe a 10 or a few tens of kilowatts of power to operate. Now that's not so much of a problem. That's probably the sort of power that a small rack in a data center would use, right? Mm-hmm. If you're talking about the other technologies that I was talking about before, superconductors, photonics, et cetera, because they need so many separate refrigerators, that the energy costs add up very quickly. And so for those technologies, you're starting to look at energy consumption at the level of megawatts. So, you know, you have to start contemplating having a actual energy, energy plant nearby, like a power station effectively, to power just one quantum computer. In contrast, as I was saying, because we just need one refrigerator, we can deal with a couple of kilowatts of power. And this is particularly important from the perspective that, you know, Dirac, our company, is focusing on making quantum computing as ubiquitous as possible. So we don't want to just have one great big quantum computer that, you know, you have to line up to use. And because actually you mentioned seconds before to do a complex calculation. Many of these calculations, even on a powerful quantum computer, will still take minutes and sometimes hours. So it's a bit like supercomputers today, when you run very complex tasks, they can take quite a bit of time to chug through the problem. And, you know, and so you often have to queue up the jobs to get these problems done. But, you know, if we're going to make this a ubiquitous technology that, you know, everyone can access, we want to have hundreds, ultimately thousands of quantum computers sitting in a data center. And that's really only going to be viable if we can make them compact and we can make them low power. And that's really the focus of our company, Dirac, to, you know, make quantum computing ubiquitous for the world.
Now, the Australian federal government has just done a deal with a company that, although it was founded by an Australian, is a company based in California to build a fault-tolerant quantum computer by 2029. Now, haven't you just described that you're effectively working on the same thing and you want to deliver it a year earlier?
Yes, I'll qualify the time scale. Yes, yep. We are, just like PsiQuantum, trying to develop fault-tolerant quantum computers. I know them well because the CEO, Jeremy O'Brien of PsiQuantum, did his PhD at UNSW with myself and also my colleague, Bob Clark. So we were his supervisors many years ago, right, back in 1999. So, and look, they're a great team. They've got impressive technology. I obviously wish them well on that venture and so on. The we are focusing at Dirac on getting a system not doing full error correction by 2028. We are planning to have the fault tolerant capability, the full error corrected quantum computing, 2 to 3 years later than that. So I should note that perhaps if we had $1 billion of investment, we might move our timescale forward a little bit earlier. But we're working on the timescales that are possible given, you know, the investment pathways that we're currently planning. We do not in any way underestimate that this is a genuinely very challenging engineering task. The basic physics are worked out for our technology, but there's a huge amount of engineering to be done to bring up a fully corrected quantum computer in any technology. I wish PsiQuantum well with their target to hit that in 2029. They're looking to build a large building in Brisbane to house this large quantum computer they're building. They've got good people. I wish them well. We are primarily focused on getting quantum computers that can be small, can be low energy usage, and our engineering roadmap is very, very well mapped out. Our view is to do a generation one quantum computer for Dirac in around 2028. That's the first system that we will make available that will go beyond existing supercomputing for a range of problems, and our fault tolerant systems a few years later.
Sure. And despite reports that the Australian government didn't consult the Australian Quantum Computing Advisory Board, which is a bit of a surprise given it seems to have sort of surprised the Australian industry. I mean, there are still obviously positives to this deal because it's now shined a massive spotlight on Australian quantum computing companies like Dirac and presumably others, and it should help accelerate everyone's efforts in this regard.
Yes, look, I won't comment on the process that was undertaken by the government. There's been plenty of reports in the media, and I best not buy into that. Mm. I think that what this investment shows is that the Australian government recognises the enormous importance of quantum computing for the future of the world. I know that also a fact that's not often known is that Australia actually, in the 1940s, had one of the first conventional computers in the world built by CSIRO. It was called CSIRAC. Similar to ENIAC in the US. It was, I think, it was the fourth large computer on the planet. And that technology, of course, never really got developed further in Australia. And Australia really missed the boat with the conventional computing industry. And I know that the Australian government does not want that to happen again. It really wants to be a world player in the global quantum computing industry. And I know that, this investment is part of Australia doing that. Australia really got into the quantum computing game at the research level very early. So at UNSW, where I've now been for nearly 30 years, I mentioned before, Jeremy O'Brien did his PhD there. Our university has been the headquarters for the National Centre for Quantum Computing since 2000. And generally in Australia, there's a wealth of talent in the hard quantum computing hardware, quantum computing algorithms, use cases. It really is one of the great locations in the world for the development of talent and the development of ideas and knowledge. It's generated a massively disproportionate amount of the research on the planet in quantum computing. And I think that one thing that I will say, the Australian government recognises what we have in Australia, and it wants to ensure that talent is taken full advantage of. So I think that's the story behind that investment. Our company, and I know there are other quantum computing companies in Australia doing hardware and also doing software, are all very, very keen that the Australian government will continue with further investments across the industry here. We're hoping that this will just be the start of a range of investments by the Australian government to support the industry here. But it is an exciting time to be an Australian quantum computing company. There's no question about it.
Well, that's at least a very positive thing to come out. And again, we don't want to miss out on this quantum computing revolution, and it looks like we're definitely not going to be doing that. But Andrew, we need to take a break. And another thing not to miss out on is to be sure to download the TNT Radio app from either the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store, so you can easily watch or listen live to us anywhere and at any time, in addition to being able to go to YouTube and Rumble and other places online. So you can download the app right now. We are keeping you up to speed on today's News Talk TNT. See you after the break.
She used to dance and dream of a better life, a brighter future, with nutritious food to eat, a chance to learn, to get an education, and do incredible things. Today, thanks to Children International and friends like you, she dances for the world. Together, we give children in poverty a chance to set their sights high and achieve their dreams by ensuring that they have access to health care, education, life skills, and more so they can grow, thrive, and believe in themselves.
Gracias. Gracias.
Learn more about Children International and join us in our life-changing work at children.org today.
You ever heard of a polyp? Sounds like a rare species of toad. Actually, it's a lump that grows inside me, your bowel. Look, I'm pretty sure if you had a strange lump growing on your forehead, you might get it looked at, right? But when they're growing inside me, nothing, nada. And the polyps I get can lead to Australia's second deadliest cancer. So, until there's a way to make them grow on your face, it's up to you to get me looked at. Got it?
Alex Zaharoff-Reut and Talkin' Tech on today's News Talk TNT.
My guest is Andrew Jurak, the CEO and founder of computing company Dirac. Now, Andrew, thanks for being here again. What is the story of the company being named Dirac? Is it named, well, you mentioned already that it's named after a professor who was working in quantum computing, you know, many years ago. And his name was D-I-R-A-C, and you've spelled it with a Q, which I'm presuming is to allude to quantum.
That's exactly right. The company name's inspired by Paul Dirac or Dirac. He was a British physicist. The name, I think his father was French. Sorry, Swiss. He was in Cambridge in the 1920s when he developed some core principles of quantum theory. And in fact, I already mentioned, you mentioned Schrodinger's cat. I mentioned Erwin Schrodinger, who is Austrian. He was one of the other main founders. And in fact, Paul Dirac and Erwin Schrodinger received the Nobel Prize jointly in 1933 for the development of quantum theory. Werner Heisenberg, a German, was the other person who also got a Nobel Prize the previous year for the same theory. So we wanted to honor Paul Dirac. There's actually another reason, and that is that as part of his discoveries in quantum theory, Paul Dirac combined quantum theory that had first been proposed by Schrodinger together with Einstein's theory of special relativity. And when he put those two theories together, he came up with a thing that's now called the Dirac equation. And the Dirac equation predicted both the existence of antiparticles, which at the time had never been seen, but were discovered a few years later. So, for example, the positron or the antiproton, particles like that. But it also predicted the property of electrons known as spin. And so that's actually the property that we use to encode the information with our electron qubits. So electrons, people probably know, well, people might know, are negatively charged, okay, negatively charged particles, but they also have a tiny magnetic field or magnetic moment, and that's associated with a property called its spin. You can kind of think about it like a little fuzzy ball of charge rotating on its axis, and it can either rotate clockwise or counterclockwise. And so if it rotates clockwise, then you can think of that as a zero. If it's anti-clockwise, it's a one. And this is the way we can store information on the electrons, and we control that spin between the zero and the one, and we read it out. So anyway, that's why we chose Dirac as the name.
Sure. And I mean, it's fascinating to think that this technology has been worked on for, you know, close to 100 years, and it really is looking at some of the fundamental, I guess, building blocks of, you know, life itself. But when did you first encounter quantum computing as a concept?
Yeah, so I was at UNSW, and I'd already mentioned a guy called Bob Clark, who was a professor there who recruited me. I'd been doing my PhD in Cambridge. I am Australian originally, but did PhD in Cambridge. He got me back to UNSW, and he also hired some other very talented people. And one of them was an American guy called Bruce Kane. And Bruce he'd done his PhD with Nobel Prize winner Dan Tsui, and he'd then been working at Bell Labs, and then he came to UNSW, hired by Bob Clark, who I mentioned, and Bruce came up with a brilliant concept of using actually the nuclear spin of phosphorus nuclei embedded in silicon, and in order to do quantum computing. And he wrote a single author Nature paper, which is a very rare thing, in 1998. And I first learned about it when I was actually, I remember I was having breakfast with Bruce in Tokyo. We were at a conference, a solid state physics conference, and Bruce told me about the concept, and I was absolutely intrigued and amazed. And actually it was that concept in that paper which really triggered the establishment of the Center for Quantum Computing at UNSW. And indeed, there are now multiple companies that are looking at silicon as a material for quantum computing in addition to Dirac.
So was it that moment that then drew you to founding a company, seeing as you could solve some of the fundamental problems to bringing this computing advance to life? Or was it something a bit further down the track, that some other development, and you thought, well, wow, we can do this?
Yeah, so I realized pretty early on that and appreciated how revolutionary quantum computing could be. So as I mentioned, the center was founded by my mentor, Bob Clark, in 2000 at UNSW in Australia. And I realized soon after the enormous potential of it, and also, of course, the commercial potential. And so at the time, you know, worked with Bob and others to start to file patents. And we actually formed a very early stage company to hold patents. So I always was very interested in the commercial prospects. But really, it was around about between 2012 and 2014 when the idea of making quantum bits using these modified silicon transistors began to become a reality. I'd been playing around in my research group with modified silicon transistors, actually to read out a different type of quantum bit. But in doing so, it became clear that we had the possibility to actually use these modified transistors as quantum bits themselves. And once I realized that we could do this with standard silicon chip technology, I just thought, wow, this has got to be commercially valuable and has such an advantage over competing technologies. So I then worked for some time through the twists and turns of relationships with university and IP and legal arrangements and IP arrangements. And I won't tell you how the sausage is made, but in the end, the sausage was Dirac as it launched in 2022.
Yeah. And just recently, I mean, I was at the launch, you opened your new lab at the University of New South Wales with under the banner of the Dirac company. Mm-hmm. And you had a bunch of investors, and Ed Husic was there to launch it.
That's right. Yep. It was great to have the industry minister, industry and science minister, Ed Husic, launching it. We also had Australia's chief scientist, Kathy Foley, there, who's really been a champion of quantum computing in Australia, and a range of our investors. We originally launched in 2022 with an international investment firm, Electus Capital, part of ICM, and then most recently, our second investment round was led by a French company called Quantination, which itself is led by a very impressive gentleman, Christoph Jerzak, who did his PhD with another Nobel Prize winner, Alain Aspect. So, we've got some great people involved at the investment side of the company, and we certainly have very strong support broadly from our government.
So is there anything else we need to know about Dirac before I ask you some closing questions?
Simply that it's a great place to be at the moment. The team are super excited. We have recently got over the last couple of months the first of our chips back from our chip manufacturing foundry partner, and we're getting incredibly promising results on those chips. I'm afraid I can't give you an exclusive tonight, but we're looking in the very, very near future to make an announcement on the results that we're getting from the chips from one of our foundry partners, and it's very, very encouraging.
So can you please share a memory of your first computer? It's a favorite question I always love to ask because often people's answers are quite different.
Yeah, look, I think that, well, I'll give you a twofold or threefold. My father, who passed away many years ago, was a very keen chess player. And I remember when he got his first chess computer, it was I probably would have been, you know, around about 12 or 13 years old. So this would be like the late 70s, early, late 70s. And I remember, you know, playing chess against it with my dad. And so I guess that was the first computing experience I had. And then when I was at high school, you know, we were doing computer science, and I think we had an Apple II. I think it was an Apple II that I used to do my first learning about programming and so on at high school. So that would have been 1982, 1983 sort of period. The first computer I ever owned was an Apple Macintosh. And that was during my PhD in Cambridge. And I wrote my thesis on that Apple Macintosh. And those are my computer history stories.
Yeah, well, like I said, often the stories are quite different. I mean, it's not Commodore 64s for everybody. No one has yet told me that their first computing device was a chess computer. So there you go. Now, my second last question is to ask if you could please share some of the best advice you've received in life to help you get where you are today.
Best advice I've ever had, and which I, you know, give to people is that follow your passion wherever you can. I consider myself a very happy and lucky person because I am doing something that I love and that gives me enormous satisfaction, and that's because I'm passionate about it. I recognize it's not always possible, but you know, if we try as hard to follow our passions, that's all we can ask for in life.
Absolutely. So, Andrew, what is your final message to the viewers and the listeners?
Well, keep your eye on quantum computing, and it is going to be revolutionary. It's not going to be here tomorrow, but like most revolutionary technologies, it'll end up being here sooner than you probably expect.
Well, I think between now and the end of the decade, there's going to be some quite interesting times, both with AI and security and robots and, of course, quantum computing. So Andrew Jurak, the CEO and founder of Dirac, and also Scientia, a professor of quantum engineering at the University of New South Wales, thank you so much for taking the time to explain quantum computing and what you're doing with us today. And I do hope we can speak again in the future.
Absolutely, Alex. It's been a pleasure. Good night.
Thank you. Good night. So let's keep on going. We've got a couple more minutes to go in the show. Reports say that Microsoft has built the very first AI model that is completely disconnected from the internet. So US spy agencies can analyze intel and top secret documents without the risk of data breaches or being snooped on by foreign agencies. At the Met Gala, there was an AI-generated image of Katy Perry that was fake, but it was so convincing that reports say it fooled Katy Perry's mother. So that whole thing about deep fakes is continuing to cause issues for people. And we're no doubt going to see plenty more of these deepfakes during the run-up to the US elections over the next few months. There's also the interesting news that OpenAI is exploring how to let developers and users responsibly create AI-generated explicit and definitely not safe for work content using its products. AI-based pornography? Well, already there are AI-generated influencers that are reportedly earning big bucks every month. And in fact, there were a number of apps, AI generation image apps, that were removed from the Apple and Google Play stores because although the feature was not advertised, they were able to create these kinds of not safe for work images. And they were subsequently removed because that wasn't part of the sort of terms of service that Apple allows for people to be able to have apps that can generate that. Now, OpenAI's boffins say that this would be done in an age-appropriate context and apparently isn't designed to create AI pornography, but that no deepfakes would be permitted, with a spokesperson saying, "We want to ensure that people have maximum control to the extent that it doesn't violate the law or other people's rights, but enabling deepfakes is out of the question, period." But then we had Warren Buffett talking about how AI can be compared to nuclear weapons, and that he'd seen AI deepfakes of himself, which would have easily have fooled his wife and children. So who knows what is going on there, but clearly, there's a lot more to go. Now, that almost brings us to the end of the show. If you're watching live on Saturday, the illustrious Lembit Opik, live from London, is up next over the few hours. And of course, he is must watch. If you're watching the replay on Sunday, another of our great presenters or shows is set to follow. And if you're listening to a podcast or a vodcast of this or any TNT Radio.live show, I'd love you to rate and subscribe so you can pass the show and this great network on to other people. You'll see me live next Wednesday on the great Chris Smith show during the second half of the second hour. And I look forward to your company next weekend. May all your electric dreams come true. And I'll see you in Chris Smith show during the second half of the second hour. And I look forward to your company next weekend. May all your electric dreams come true. And I'll see you next week on here on TNTRadio.live. Well, a bit more to go. Yes. Okay. So there's still more, plenty more. I mean, as I said, Google next week is having its giant developer conference. Now, here we're going to hear AI nonstop. They're going to mention it several times during the course. It's going to be on their phones, on their tablets, and you'll be able to go to the Chrome browser and use the little at symbol and type at Gemini, and then you can type in your question, and it will bring up the Gemini website, gemini.google.com. I've also been playing with meta.ai, asking it to create poems for me. I was actually talking with Sonia Poulton earlier this week about dead bots and grief bots. So, the AI continues to amaze and surprise us all, which is really quite astounding. And we'll continue to follow that here on TNT Radio Live. As I was saying, up next is Lembit Opik. I love to watch your show. And look, there's you are in the right place for the latest news, whether it is technology, whether it is politics, whether it is freedom. Stick with TNTRadio.live.